Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Suderstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. I'm here with my co-host, Alfred Addis, bringing you opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events for Wednesday. I'm sorry, for Thursday, July 3rd, 2014. Sorry about that, folks. I do know what day it is. We do have the interview. It's Thursday. We have the interview with James Corbett today. So we'll be going into that here shortly. But first, we're going to have the market report. And as I told you, they would certainly get the Dow up to 17,000 for the holiday weekend. There'd be a little bit of pressure on gold. And, you know, the charts won't tell you that. And it's very simple to figure it out, and it's but you know, gold today did have a little bit of pressure, down $7.70 at $1,320. You have silver down; it's coming back, down only down two at $21.23. Platinum was down 11 at $1,503, along with palladium up one at $862. So they've all come off their lows of the day. We actually had a low of gold of 1308 and silver 2069. So they did rebound nicely, considering jobs report today, which the job report showed that the U.S. economy added 288,000 jobs in June. The job growth was also revised higher for both May and April. Taken all together, that means employers added 1.4 million jobs in the first 6 months of the year, and that's the strongest 6 months for job growth since 2006. Now, does it even really make sense? Because you have the GDP that just dropped considerably, and if you compare what was going on in 2006 compared to today, how does anybody believe those numbers? The unemployment rate did drop 6.1%, down from 6.3%. And as of June, 3 million Americans were unemployed for 6 months or longer. Hourly wages rose 0.2% and are up 2% in the past 12 months. But do you really believe that they're keeping up with rising prices? No. But that's not what you're going to hear coming out of Washington. And, of course, 71% of Americans, there was a poll, Washington Obama is still trying to get the minimum wage increased. 71% of Americans support raising the minimum wage. And I really don't believe they understand what that minimum wage, that's not the problem. The problem is the price of things. The problem is our inflation that our wages can't cover. And we have low wages. And but people really don't understand all the problems, and it's just not as simple as raising the minimum wage. Someone will pay for it. And the administration is also asking Congress to pass a transportation bill this summer. They're hoping that it'll it'll help to increase the construction sector for jobs. And all the jobs that they talk about that were created, or the people that were hired, they're not all quality jobs. You still have people who are getting part-time jobs in June. The number of full-time workers declined. Is that healthy? Does that sound like a healthy economy? And as of June, about 7.5 million Americans said they were stuck in a part-time job, even though they would prefer to work part-time. Doesn't sound like a great economy to me. So we did have the stock market high. You did have the gold prices drop, and of course the Dow finished out today on a record, of course, over 17,000, up 92 points at 17,068. The NASDAQ was up 28 points at 44.85, along with the S&P up 10 at 19.85, and the 10-year yield, that started to move up 2.65%. So we knew this was how the week would finish, so no big surprises. And Germany today, Germany's BMW, they're deciding to invest $1 billion to build a new luxury car factory. Do you think it's going to be in the U.S.? No, it's going to be in northern Mexico. They build them close to the border, so they can take advantage of all of this open border trade. The BMW board member, Harold Kruger, says the plant in the northern state of San Luis Potosi will have the capacity to make 150,000 cars per year. He made the announcement today in Mexico City, and he says BMW has 28 factories in 13 countries. And, of course, remember, it was just last week that we reported that Daimler and Renault Nissan said they would invest $1.6 billion in a factory to make compact cars in Mexico. Well, it seems like the European Central Bank is sort of following along with the Obama administration. The European Central Bank is overhauling the way it sets monetary policy, saying it will hold fewer meetings, and they're going to publish the minutes. It also sounds like the Federal Reserve, but they want to be more transparent as it vows to keep supporting the economy by any means available. The bank did decide today to keep its interest rates on hold, and the President Mario Draghi told a press briefing that the European Central Bank remains committed to taking more action to the 18-country eurozone to make it grow faster and emerge from a period of dangerously low inflation. Oh, they're going to, they will succeed on battling their low inflation, because inflation will be coming to them just as we have it coming to us. So, no surprise there. So, a lot of things going on. It's the July 4th weekend. That is tomorrow, July 4th, and it never ceases to amaze me, comments that comes from people and their thoughts and their views of what July 4th is all about. I got into a little debate on Facebook today, and I should know better. I should know better. Just walk away. Don't say anything. But it truly is amazing, and it is frustrating. So we do have to remember what July 4th is all about, what Independence Day is all about, because it's just not all about burgers and hot dogs. But I want to wish everyone an enjoyable day tomorrow. And I do believe we have the interview coming up with James Corbett here that we recorded. And I just want to wish everyone a wonderful weekend.
I didn't like that. This is not very good. This, all this sugar is not so good anymore, and withdrawing from it is perhaps even worse.
Reality is not bad as long as you live in it, but it's for those who...
Sometimes it's even bad for when you... I mean, reality is always challenging, but we're caught... We all have our little delusions. We all have our little lies in our own way. But
not me.
Sometimes you are forced to deal with the truth. And not by choice. You are forced to deal with the truth. And maybe that's where we're coming. We've got a guest on the line, James Corbett from the Corbett Report. He's the author, editor of the Corbett Report. And he will be our guest for the balance of the program. We'll tell you more about the Corbett Report in a moment. Matter of fact, I'll tell you right now, he's been living and working in Japan since 2004, started the Corbett Report in 2007, has an independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. He's an editorial writer for the International Forecaster, which is the weekly newsletter created by the recently deceased economic analyst Bob Chapman. And James is online from Japan. Hello, James. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How's our connection doing today?
Sounds good. Sounds good so far. You know how these things go, though.
Yeah.
Never guarantee. You know, they sound good for a while, and then maybe they don't, but we'll see. It's always amazing, as we've said before. We can use Skype, and that's how we're doing this. We are talking. I'm in Texas. Melody's in Pennsylvania. Jim Corbett's in Japan. And we're able to talk and put on a radio program with generally very few technological problems, right? There's exceptions to that, but generally, and it's pretty amazing and free besides. So let's start with Japan. Let me see if I can find my notes on this. Here's an article from the New York Times, and the headline is Japan announces a military shift to thwart China. And Japan's prime minister announced a reinterpretation of the country's pacifist constitution on Tuesday, freeing its military for the first time in over 60 years to play a more assertive role in the increasingly tense region. They are concerned about China, of course. The newspaper says the hawkish Mr. Abe's response is certain to anger the Chinese. Is this much ado about nothing or something significant? Is Japan really shifting its military stance?
Yes, it is. I would say this is fairly significant. I suppose it's not surprising. We've known for some time, in fact, since at the very least since Shinzo Abe became the Prime Minister of Japan here in December 2012, we've known that his government has been aiming at this type of move, this shift very hard towards the right end of the nationalist spectrum and towards the old imperialist tendencies of Japan in the war era, but unfortunately here we are, and it seems that this plan has not only not been derailed but has come to fruition, despite the fact that polls here show that a majority of the Japanese people are against this move. So for people who don't know about the sort of background to this, basically Japan had its constitution written during the occupation in that period right after the end of the Second World War. And one of the things that was hard-coded into that constitution was Article 9, which is a pretty remarkable article for a constitution of a major developed power, which is that Japan committed itself not to have any external offensive military capability, which, again, is a pretty amazing thing to have hard-coded right in the constitution. And for a country that had been so militaristic in the decades leading up to that, again, quite an amazing turnaround. And that Article 9 has really been taken to heart by much of the Japanese population, and I can really attest to that from my experiences with the Japanese people. In my travels around the globe, I have never found a generally more peaceful and peace-loving people. It really has become a part of the culture, and a lot of people do take pride in Japan's peaceful nature, the way that it has developed over the last several decades, the fact that it is now a country that has largely prided itself on its position of peace. But that has been changing in recent decades. And for example, last decade, we saw the Japanese Self-Defense Force, which is what the Japanese military really is called, and it's technically a part of the Japanese police force. It's not actually a military, although it's a military in all but name. And the Japanese Self-Defense Force was helping the United States in Iraq providing some logistic aid, not actually involved in any combat. So that's how they skirted those rules, but giving logistic help to the American invasion and occupation. And that was seen as a pretty major move towards the remilitarization of Japan. And since that time, we've seen more worrying moves. And this is the boldest move yet. Basically, the Shinzo Abe government has now reinterpreted Article 9 to mean that, yes, there is no offensive military capability, sort of first strike capability that the Japanese military can use. But now they're invoking this idea of collective self-defense. So if one of Japan's allies is in trouble, they'll be able to use their military to come to its aid. And again, there's a majority of the people, it varies according to the poll, but somewhere around 54% are against this. We saw some huge protests taking place here on Tuesday when this was finally formally made part of the Japanese government's official interpretation of the law. And we even saw people self-immolating. Someone set himself on fire as part of the protest. I mean, it is really, pardon the pun, it's really ignited the passions of a lot of people here. Because again, it really is a touchstone issue for so many people and how they define themselves and their Japanese nationality.
How important was Japan's pacifism to its economic success after World War II? While we were fumbling around making more rockets and bombs over in this country, Japan was making automobiles.
That's very true.
Did lay the foundation for their economic success, or did it play a role in it?
Well, there certainly is a case to be made that basically all of that industry of war was basically just shifted over into the high tech sector and eventually became the industrial base from which Japan launched its amazing restoration after the Second World War and its rise to economic prominence. I think there's definitely a relation there. And I think the other side of that equation is that Japan basically, of course, just submitted itself to being under the U.S. military umbrella and being a basically U.S. proxy in the Pacific region. And as such, it was able to benefit from that relationship greatly economically as well. So I think that there is definitely a relation between the types of the positions that the Japanese government took in the wake of the Second World War and its rise to economic prominence.
What do you think that the Japanese are shifting back towards their former imperialism? Not to say that they've embraced that entirely, but how close is Japanese imperialism? How much does it parallel the neoconservatism in the United States? And are they similar? And is this similarity merely a coincidence, or is it evidence of something else that's happening in the world?
I would say there are similarities. I think they come from different backgrounds and are perhaps differently motivated. And it's not, for example, explicitly religiously tied here, although the neoconservatives, of course, attempt to wear the mask of the religious right in the United States and all of that type of thing. So the politics is slightly different. But I think the underlying ideology is the same. And, of course, I mean, it's called neoconservatism. You could call it neoliberalism. It's really the same thing. It's the sort of globalist ideology that is pervading many different places around the globe. And I think it's just another manifestation of that. But of course, it does have those specifically Japanese cultural and historical ties to that imperialist era. And there's certainly a section of the hard right nationalist elements here in Japan who do want that revivification of the Japanese imperial era. And I think that basically the rise of China as an economic and military threat in the region has given them the perfect excuse to accomplish this.
We see something similar. I think we all long for the past. It's a popular, not too many people are simply looking forward to the future. Some are. But a lot of people, including myself, have a sentimental feeling for the era when the founding fathers were in this country and when we had more freedom and liberty and so on. We see people in Japan that are, to some degree, hearkening, but they're saying, we wish we could get back to the imperial era. They want that. We've got Vladimir Putin over in Russia, wishing that he could restore the former grandeur of the Union of Soviet Socialistic Republics. Is there something happening in the world where we're all looking over our shoulder and wishing the past was, we were still at some point in the past? And does it indicate that we're not very optimistic about the future?
Well, it certainly indicates that there is something missing in the current global political order. And I think that missing element is the sense of at least a stability in power relations, which is brought about by either a unitary, monolithic, sort of overarching, single hegemon like the United States Empire, or in the bilateral sort of dual superpowers of the old Soviet American Cold War era. I think there's something of a power vacuum on the international stage right now, and of course there are going to be people who are going to attempt to fill that in whatever way they possibly can to try to come to the head of the table. And so you see, I think, Putin trying to do that in the creation of his Eurasian Union. You see that, of course, in the quest for European Union and integration with the United States in some of the trade agreements that are being worked on. You see that in the Asian region. You see China trying to step into that role. You see the ASEAN nations trying to basically stop China from taking that, and various people trying to come to the head, including, of course, now Japan.
Let's get back to that in a moment. Jim, we'll have to break for some commercials, and Mr. Jim Corbett and I will be back in a moment. James is from the Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com. We'll be back shortly. Please stay tuned to Financial Survival.
A heart condition and emergency rooms and medical doctors are not an option, you need our emergency heart attack kit. 5 concentrated liquid formulas enter the system in 60 seconds to protect your heart muscle, strengthen heartbeat, increase circulation, relieve pain, and make breathing easier. When seconds count, you want all the help you can get with our emergency heart attack kit. Easy to use and portable in a 1-pound compact kit for your purse, briefcase, or car. Call Apothecary Herbs now for your emergency heart attack kit toll-free, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. International callers dial 704-875-8010 or order online at thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
American Voice Radio Network is heard on Galaxy 19 at 97 degrees west, transponder 23, frequency 12115, audio PID 2595. AVR is heard on the left side audio channel, and AVR 2 is heard on the right side audio channel. Remember, both AVR and AVR 2 are on Galaxy 19. Same network, double the choices.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Adusk here on Financial Survival with Melody Cederstrom and our guest, James Corbett. James is calling from Japan. He is the editor, publisher, and principal writer for the Corbett Report, which you can find on the internet at CORBETTREPORT, CorbettReport.com. We were talking about the idea that people are looking over their shoulder to the past. Putin is looking to the past to some degree in Russia. He longs for the might of the former Soviet Union. We have people in Japan that are to some degree looking back to the might of the former Imperial Army. We've got people in this country that look back to the era of our founding fathers, or even the era of Ronald Reagan, and during the Cold War when we were clearly the world superpower and we weren't confused and divided. And I posed the question to Jim earlier. I said, is this a reflection of general pessimism about the future? And we talked about that. And what I want to back up and ask that question one more time is our tendency to look backwards evidence of fear of the future, not just pessimism, but fear? And if so, is that fear dangerous?
Well, I think that's probably more to the point. Fear mm-hmm. based on, of course, the uncertainty of the situation. And you're right, there's a certain comfort that comes from certainty, even if that certainty is the fact that you are not the superpower. As long as there is that well-defined geopolitical relation, at least you can kind of find your footing in it and you know your place. But in these times of transition, I think that the public certainly senses an uncertainty. And the politicians are able to use that sort of sentimentality for the past and past relations and play on that in the public in order to try to build up their own stake in whatever the new order coming into view might be. So I think that's really the moment that we find ourselves in, historically speaking. And that's always a worrying moment from the bigger perspective, because, of course, it's in times like these that we really do see major types of military confrontations and changes in geopolitical relations, which is, I think, something that we have to keep in mind for the coming years. I really do think that we're in an era where it is much more likely to see major military confrontations taking place.
And we're sliding into an era of greater instability. And everyone picks up on this. We understand something's happening in the Ukraine. We understand something's happening in the Middle East. We understand that tensions are rising in Asia due to China and perhaps tensions between China and Japan. We see this happening on a global basis, and there is no one who's going to stop this. There was a time when the world could rely on the United States to step in and mitigate, moderate, stop some of these conflicts. At least that was part of our mindset. We believed that. Who's going to stop? Who will solve these problems now? Is there any force on earth that's able to mitigate these, control these unstable regions?
Well, not unilaterally, at any rate. I think mm-hmm. we certainly have entered an era of multilateralism, which again plays, I think, into the long-term strategic goal of globalism, which of course is to create that system where there is no clear unitary single superpower that would have the authority or the ability to act unilaterally, so that these types of multilateral relations have to be built up. And of course, the institutions for wielding power multinationally have already, of course, been building up for decades now. And perhaps militarily speaking, the most obvious example would, of course, be the increasingly inaccurately named North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which now has literally partners and members to its global partnership program all over the globe, including even here in the Pacific, in Korea and places like this, where they have Korea as a partner. Again, NATO is just an unbelievably large military alliance at this point that really does represent, I think, that military power that the United States itself used to represent.
All right, but will the multinationals, will they be able to work together? Can we assume that they're going to work together, or will they fragment or perhaps attempt to work together and fail? And the reason I'm asking this, are we looking at some, we don't have the United States used to run the world in a sense. That's an exaggeration, but to the sense they controlled the world in a sense. We had a certain amount of stability. It's not providing that anymore. If the multinationals don't, what comes next? Does this open the door for a new world order and a single global government?
Well, again, I think that's ultimately where things are trending, and mm-hmm. that can only happen through the failure of the existing system. So yep. at a certain point, there does have to be a failure, and I imagine that that failure will take the form of a major military confrontation. There will be some sort of World War III type scenario before that type of global order can ever be instituted. And I think, again, this is not really going out on a limb. This is something that's just obvious. I think it's impossible to imagine that type of global order coming into view without some sort of major confrontation taking place first. And this was a phenomenon that was identified before the First World War, and it of course held sway in the course of the First World War, which led to the creation of the League of Nations, the course of the Second World War, which led to the creation of the United Nations. I think it would not be surprising at all. In fact, it would be surprising if the Third World War did not lead to the creation of some similar and perhaps more powerful global institution.
And the further implication is that World War III may not be an accident per se, that accidentally results in a new world order. But for those who want a new world order, perhaps they recognize that World War III is a necessity for them to achieve their objective. And therefore the war, new next war, if there's going to be one, it won't be an accident. I don't know if they ever are, but it won't be an accident. It'll be someone says, we can gain power by killing millions of people.
Well, again, this is a very elementary, just sort of logical phenomenon that comes out of these premises. And so the question is exactly right. I mean, if there are people who are interested in a global order, then the only way to do that is to provoke the crises that will create it. And I think, or at the very least, to allow those crises to develop. And I think we can see that phenomenon taking place in a lot of different ways, and perhaps one way to get a better handle on that rather than sort of the World War III scenario is to look in the microcosm at what's happening at the European Union and in the Eurozone right now. And in fact, I wrote about this in the last edition of the Forecaster, where I wrote about the New York Times picking up on a new study from a London-based economic think tank that, lo and behold, maybe the European Union, maybe the Eurozone isn't out of its recession after all. Because we've seen since the beginning of 2013, we've seen a very anemic but still slightly positive growth rate in the European economy, somewhere under 1%, which means that technically it is out of recession, according to the official numbers. But this new think tank study is basically saying, well, either we'll start to see the acceleration in that growth rate and the recession will be really over, or we'll see it plummet once again into the negative territory, in which case this period won't really be the Eurozone out of recession. It will only be a sort of pause in the recession. And the interesting part of that is that when the New York Times covered that, they made very explicit towards the end of that little blog post that the think tank stressed that the reason that they were hesitant to say that the Eurozone is out of recession is because that removes the crisis mentality from the policymakers at the ECB and in the various national governments that comprise the Eurozone. And that sense of crisis is absolutely essential to forwarding the European Union's agenda, to forwarding the creation and fostering of this union. As long as it is in crisis, the policymakers have more of leeway to act on that crisis. Yeah. They have more of a mandate from the public to do so. So again, that's the phenomenon in microcosm that I think we're going to see in macrocosm when it comes to the type of World War III scenario. Create the crisis, foster the crisis, make sure the crisis mentality is there, and you will have much greater leeway to implement your agenda.
I follow what you're saying, and when I think back on it, this certainly isn't a new principle. For example, we can see it in the American Revolution. The Declaration of Independence created 13 independent states, which were as independent from each other as France was from Germany. But that was 1776. 5 years later, threatened, all 13 states, independent states, were still threatened by the external King George. He was still posing a threat. They were exposed to what they perceived to be something like a national threat, and therefore they created the Articles of Confederation and the United States of America. And they came together because they faced a common threat. If that common threat hadn't been there, we would still have 13 nations sitting on the east coast of the United States, and God only knows how many more on the balance of the continent. Now, the point I'm making is that if you want the implication is that if you want a global government, you have to first create a global threat. The whole world has to agree that there is a threat. It's not just a threat to the United States, because that's not enough to move everybody in the rest of the world and say, oh, we'll sign up. It's got to be a global threat, and that implies World War III. It's consistent with the, your prediction. When you talk about World War III, are we talking about the use of nuclear weapons on a limited, unlimited, or no use at all? Limited, unlimited basis or no use at all? What do you think?
Again, it's difficult to predict things like this, but my sense would be that there would be a limited use. There would have to. I imagine in a World War III scenario that leads to the creation of a new global order, there would have to be a pretty major and pretty traumatic series of events in order to move the public's opinion along. Just as the First World War introduced the public to the horrors of mechanized warfare and the trench warfare that was a hugely new phenomenon in terms of battlefield strategy and the psychology of how it affected the people who were fighting, and the way it really changed the narrative of warfare itself from this sort of idyllic thing to be glorified and, oh, we're going to spill our blood on the battlefields for king and country, into the sort of nightmare of this trench warfare psychological horror story that played out for a lot of people. It really fractured the narrative, and the Second World War went even further towards that, and of course ended with the trauma of the nuclear threat. And I think the Third World War would have to similarly really change people's fundamental perceptions of warfare, of our geopolitical relations, of what's possible and what could happen. So perhaps not even nuclear war, although I think limited nuclear strikes would be likely in such a scenario, but perhaps the development of some sort of new type of weapon that we can only but dimly comprehend or imagine at this point. Again, all bets are off the table when it comes to this type of scenario, but I think that, again, for people who are trying to bring in a new global order, there would have to be something profoundly different about this war than previous wars in order to get the public to clamor for a solution, because we must not let this happen again.
I think if I had to guess, thinking about this as you talk about it, I'm inclined to think that there'd have to be something like nuclear war. I'm inclined to think that it would be limited, because assuming that the New World Order wants a war that will lay the foundation for the New World Order, assuming that premise is true, their object is to control the world, not to destroy the world. But they have to scare the world pretty badly to get them to submit to the control of the New World Order. One of the things that crosses my mind is that we would expect to see nuclear weapons launched by a number of different countries. It wouldn't just be one country or two that fired nuclear weapons. It would have to be a host of nuclear weapons, a host of countries that were using nuclear weapons, and we might see 5 or 10 that launched 1, 2, or 3 or however many nuclear weapons, and the point would be then we have to control the whole world and eliminate nuclear weapons in order to save the world, and because it wasn't just the United States, it wasn't just Russia. You follow it on?
So it wouldn't surprise me if there was something, again, that would be quite traumatic and hard to imagine in our current scenario, but something like the destruction, if not wholesale, at least in large part, of the United States, or something that's seen by the world as sort of a major power, something that's unshakable. Because, again, the sort of crumbling of this empire has to be, I think, completed before the erection of the next one can even begin. And so I think we might see something on the scale of the fall of Rome back in the times towards the end of the Roman Empire.
When do you suppose that we might expect, if there's going to be a Third World War, when do you suppose we might see it? Do you have any feeling in terms of time?
I really can't play that prediction game, because I really have no basis for being able to say that. My sense would be that it would not be in the immediate future. I don't think that the pieces are on the table quite yet. I think we still have quite a bit of groundwork to be done in terms of the laying of the narratives and the divisions, and I think smaller skirmishes would probably precede this. But again, it's subject to so many different factors, and it could all start tomorrow in the place that you least expect, because of some territorial skirmish in the South China Sea or something like that could set off a chain of events that, again, we have no access to. And that's at least the narrative that we've been fed about the start of World War One. And I think it's true to the extent that it's in a certain context, that it really was the result of this small event, seemingly small event that no one could have predicted, that set off the sort of the chain of events that led to World War One. So again, it really is, I mean, impossible to predict. But again, my sense is that there needs to be a bit more of the laying of the groundwork and the sort of the formation of the.
You're saying that there's drama. You're essentially saying that there are producers that are going to put on one of the world's biggest plays, and they've got to write the script, and they've got to get the actors prepared to play their parts, and maybe the actors don't even know how the play is going to work out, but nevertheless they're participating, and someone is producing this. It's not just happening, but it's being orchestrated and produced. We're going to take a break for some commercial announcements. I'm here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. Please stay tuned.
For their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a Ku-band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
I'm Alfred Addis, here in Financial Survival, co-host Melody Cederstrom, and our guest James Corbett from The Corbett Report, CorbettReport.com. Check it out for a great newsletter. We were talking about agency and the idea that the United States has outsourced much of its industry and other, perhaps, the proviso for commodities. You can explain how far you think this outsourcing has gone, and does it create liabilities that are going to hurt us in the future?
Well, I think it does. I mean, it certainly, if people are still believing that the United States is a government that represents a nation state that is part of a system of other nation states competing for power on the world stage, if people still see international relations even that word international certainly implies that type of structure. If people see global relations in that context, then I think they're operating in a different paradigm than the people who are really pushing this, the offshoring, for example, of the productive economic capacity of the United States. And when we start to look at those types of people and the types of things that they've been arguing for decades now and that are coming to fruition, I think we understand that this, again, has nothing to do with what we think of as traditional politics and people who are arguing or advocating for a particular nation to become the strongest in the world over the others because they have some sort of allegiance to that nation. So let's put this in specifics. I mean, when we look at the idea of China and its place in the global economy and how it's come to be there, we might look at some of the people who have been in positions of power behind the scenes in various administrations over the decades. You might look at someone, for example, like Henry Kissinger, who, of course, was explicitly in Nixon's cabinet, but has, of course, been there behind the scenes throughout administration after Republican administration after administration, including as an advisor, admittedly an advisor to George W. Bush's administration, as was revealed several years into that administration on 60 Minutes, I believe. Oh, yes, he's a daily visitor to the White House. And Henry Kissinger, of course, has called on multiple occasions and in explicit language for China to be an integral part of the new international order that he has been advocating for those several decades that he's been part of the American political machinery. And if you look at the opposite side, the quote-unquote opposite side of that political spectrum, of course, Kissinger has been associated with Republicans, so he must be right-wing. And, of course, the opposite side must be someone like George Soros, who, of course, is quite explicitly a funder and backer of the Democrats and the left side of the political spectrum. And yet he also makes the exact same case that the new international global order has to have China as its engine, which he has explicitly said China is the engine of the new world order. China must be the leader of the new world order. These are all explicit quotes of Soros in recent years. Again, how do these completely opposite people on opposite sides of the spectrum come to the exact same conclusion? And what does it mean that both of these people are not actually native-born Americans, and yet they both have incredible amount of influence over the American political process and are arguing for a strategy that will explicitly make America less important on the international stage? Again, I think people who don't see these types of connections and what they ultimately mean are just being willfully blind to the reality that's right there in front of their face.
And what about the congressmen and senators who should be bringing this issue to the attention of the American people and aren't saying a word about it? We're not just talking about Henry Kissinger or George Soros sneaking in and out of the White House once in a while to have a little talk with the president. We're talking about a whole government structure that is following their lead, even though that lead is pointing to something like a second-class status for the United States of America. How do we explain that?
Well, we certainly are talking about a structure, an entire institutional structure that supports this process. And you're exactly right. I mean, whoever is really puppeteering this, of course, there is the complicity of the rest of Congress that makes this possible. And I think we just have to look at some of the voices in the past that have gone up against these ideas and these plans and how they were dealt with. We could look at people like Senator Goldwater and the run that he made for the presidency, which was perhaps the last time that we saw anything like what we saw with the Ron Paul presidential campaign in American electoral politics. And that was, of course, roundly defeated at the polls and was basically consigned to the dustbin of history as far as the Republican Party was concerned. And then you look at Congress Congress members like Larry McDonald back in the 1980s, who ended up on Korean Airlines flight 007, that ended up accidentally flying into Soviet space and being shot down in an international incident that remains a very interesting one. And in fact, one that I did a podcast about a couple of years ago that people can check in my archives. But again, he was quite explicitly against the creation of this new international order that the Kissingers and their ilk have been talking about for a long time. And well, he's certainly not a voice on the American political scene anymore for one reason or another. And when you bring that forward to the current era, You, of course, back in the day, you had Goldwater and others writing entire books about the Trilateral Commission set up by Rockefeller and Brzezinski and people of that sort. But you get to our current era and you get someone like a Ron Paul, who would be, I think, the closest analog to a Goldwater in our modern era. But he did make certain statements about the United Nations and the Council on Foreign Relations and the undue influence of groups like that. But he certainly never made it an important part of his campaign. And he certainly didn't write entire books about that or what that meant. And I think that's a sign that there really is a line that that cannot be crossed in Washington for people who expect to stay with a seat at that table of power. And I think that's
And you're suggesting that no one who achieves any significant power in this country is willing to cross that line, even though it would perhaps be a great and heroic acts on behalf of the American people, that line still won't be crossed even by people like Ron Paul.
I would say they aren't able to cross that line, at least not able to and to live to tell the tale. And again, that's not exactly a claim that I can prove definitively, but I would say that the absence of people doing this is it's not a proof, but it is certainly compatible with that thesis.
And you think that the opposing side, you're at least implying that the opposing side is prepared to assassinate anyone who succeeds in getting in their way to a significant degree.
I certainly do. I absolutely believe that political assassination is a common tactic that continues to be used, largely through plane crashes of mysterious sorts. But certainly the idea that political assassination is not used in our day and age, as opposed to every other time and period of history, would be curious. I mean, I think that would be the position that would need to be defended.
I think if there's a difference, it would be that perhaps political assassination is taken for granted, or at least more so today than it was 100 years ago. It may have been that political assassination may have been as common then as it is now. But wasn't this the sort of thing that we watched movies about political assassination? We didn't reach a point that people didn't take it for granted. They were a little bit shocked if it happened. And they were disbelieving that it was actually inspired by a government. It was, again, the lone assassin. Do you think we've become just dulled down? Not just dumbed down, but dulled down to where we're not amazed by assassination today? Do we take it for granted?
I don't really get that sense from the general public. I mean, I think the tenor of the general public's take on this is that, well, of course, that doesn't happen. I think that that's something that's still quite largely internalized because, again, people seem to think that the historical age that they're living in is somehow exceptional and things that were commonplace in the past don't happen anymore. On a deeper level than that, I mean, we could turn to people like Bill Hicks, the comedian, of course, from the 80s and 90s, early 90s, who made that joke about, well, I imagine that every time there's a new president, they take him into a smoky boardroom and show him a video of the JFK assassination from an angle that no one's seen before, and the mm-hmm. lights come up and they ask him any questions. Quite a cynical way of looking at it, but I mean, I think that that's at the very least the implication of something like what happened with the Kennedy assassination, that the vast majority of the public in poll after poll after poll does not believe it was a single lone nut, and yet that is an absolute 100% taken for granted monolithic hypothesis that is promulgated in the mainstream.
Let's move over to Iraq a little bit and see what's going on there. What do you think is going on? And where I'm last time we had you on the program, you were explaining that the United States is funding the ISIS rebels who are trying to overthrow the Syrian government. You correct me if I'm mistaking what I remember you saying. And also ostensibly resisting the ISIS rebels who are trying to overthrow the Iraqi government. Thus, the United States is playing both ends against the middle. By doing so, does the Obama administration indicate its stupidity, its inability to extricate itself from a Middle East contradiction? Or does it indicate that America's real goal, the Obama administration's real goal, is to precipitate a significant war between the Sunni and the Shiite throughout much of the Middle East? Are we funding both sides because we want them to fight? You follow my points?
I certainly do. Well, I think that what it really indicates is the Obama administration's belief that the American public is too stupid to realize what's going on. But to be clear and to be fair, the American government, of course, does not officially admit to actually funding ISIS directly. They do admit, of course, to helping and training and funding some of the militants in Syria, but of course they call them freedom fighters and say that they're not related directly to ISIS, although as we have talked about, there have been those recent revelations that there were ISIS members who were involved in some of the training programs that the U.S. was running in Jordan on the Syrian border. So again, it's indirect in the same way that, for example, the official story of the Afghan war back in the 1980s was that America was funding the Afghanis and the help to the types of radical so-called Arab Afghans was coming from Pakistan. So America had nothing to do with it. There's always a convenient cutout. But I think we understand what's happening beneath this. And I think that, yes, one of the implications is that America does actually desire sort of the destabilization that's happening here. But I think there are a number of different forces that come together that all similarly desire the destabilization of Iraq and the potential of the splitting up of the country. Obviously, the Saudis, who are directly invested in the ISIS group and are helping to bring this this latest turmoil to fruition through direct supply of money and funding and training and even fighting soldiers, terrorists, whatever they are themselves. Also, the Turks are also interested, I think, in seeing the split up of Iraq and the chance for Turkey to become more of a regionally dominant player. Also to have some of that turmoil hopefully spill over into Iran, which would further destabilize a potential rival for regional dominance. Of course, Israel is always happy to see the various nations in the Middle East at each other's throats rather than Israel's throats. So I think this represents the coming together of a lot of different agendas, and that's why I think this is taking place in the way that it is and with the support that it is. And now, lo and behold, it turns out that some of the largest contingent of these ISIS fighters are not Afghans at all. Not Arabs at all. They're not from the region at all. They turn out to be ethnic Chechens.
We're out of time, folks. I want to thank all of you for listening. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cederstrom and our guest, James Corbett of the Corbett Report. Corbett, Corbett, report.com. Take a look. He's got some fine articles, videos, interviews. We look forward to talking to Jim again next Wednesday night. Thank you for being here, Jim.
Thank you for having me on. Talk to you next week.
Mm-hmm. Talk to you then. I'm Alfred Addis. We'll see you in the next day or so. In the meantime, may the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Frank, the producer, and Jim Corbett. Good night.
I work all night, I work all day.